stance. The dice roll every random chance. Take off your coat and stay a while. We'll roll in that D percentile.
So it's taken me a while to get round to this, but I'm really pleased that I have. I've got a new caller. Can't really call him a new caller. This is Roy of Chaos is Limb. Thanks very much. I've been really pleased to receive these messages, Roy, which I've been collecting since June, I think, and haven't got round to putting together a decent response to them. But I'm really pleased you're enjoying the show. Really grateful to receive the messages. I don't know if you've got through the back catalogue yet. Maybe these responses from Roy might be an inspiration for people to go back through the back catalogue. I'm not sure if I recommend that or not. This is really good fun because it reminds me of a lot of things that I have done episodes about over the last, well, more than a year now, since May of 2019. So thanks very much for all these calls, Roy. I won't respond to them one by one, but there will be some responses in here. I'm really pleased to receive them. Keep them coming. I would like to know whether you've caught up. I did slow down a bit in the last couple of months, so maybe that helps people going back through the back catalogue to catch up. I don't know. Cheers, Roy.
Hey, Dave. Going through your back catalogue here, heard you were in Wales and you were watching the snails crawl toward the sea. I don't know what snails are like on your side of the ocean, but over here, salt kill snails. So I'm wondering if these were particularly suicidal snails, or there's a freshwater ocean somewhere in Wales that I'm not aware of. Anyway, I'm sure someone has already remarked on this, but I just couldn't resist calling in.
Yeah, so this goes back to last August. This is a full year ago. I was on my family holiday in North Wales, where we regularly go. I don't think we're going to get there this year. World events have conspired against us. I think I can't really complain. I think we've otherwise come through this. We've been very fortunate, but I don't think we're going to get to Wales. As for the snails, yeah, I think I just my technical terminology was lacking. I probably could have called them whelks, something like that. I've never really known what a whelk was, but I'm playing Animal Crossing at the moment and I caught one and it looked just like a snail. So so maybe I should have. They were sea snails, whelks. Winkles, is a winkle like that as well? I don't know. I think we call them winkles as well in the UK. That's what they were.
Hey, Dave, still going through the back catalogue. Really love your concept of goblins. You're talking about replacing halflings with goblins and having them more fey sort of creatures. I think I'm going to steal that, although I think I'm also going to give them quite a bit of variability in size. So anything from typical goblin size to like ogre sized, I think I'm going to be pulling some flavor from like, what is that race in the Many Colored Land and the Golden Torque series. Anyway, thanks for the inspiration. You also talked about putting together a random table for a goblin market. I'm wondering if you're going to use Christina Rossetti as a possible influence, or are your games PG-13?
Thanks, Roy. Yeah, on goblins. So references to the Julian May series there, I think. I've got that on my shelf. I've never read it. I think I maybe tried to read it. Is it the Saga of the Exiles? But that sounds interesting. So I don't know anything about the alien race, fantasy race that's in there. I might have a look. We've just done my shelves. I've had great fun going through. That's a good summer job, rearranging my shelves because we built some new shelving and sorted out the old shelving. That was good fun, but I'll have a look at those. I'd love to hear how your goblins went, if you did do that in your campaign. Rossetti absolutely was. This was for my King of Dungeons campaign. I kept referring to sort of Victorian romanticism, and that's absolutely the feel that I was that I was going for. Yeah, and the goblins there come in all sorts of shapes and sort of animalistic, animal-looking, different sizes. And yeah, so that was absolutely the feel I was going for. It absolutely was PG-13, however. do I mean that? So my games do get a bit weird. We talked about this on The Worm recently. I do tend to avoid sexual themes, but everything else is up for grabs. There's always strong, disgusting body horror elements in there. But yeah, there were none of the sort of sexual implications, I don't think, came up in King of Dungeons of Goblin Market. But Rossetti was a touch point for that, yes. I did never produce that random table, like many of the other plans that I've chucked out. You'll realise as you go through the back catalogue and then not ever return to.
Hey, Dave. Hearing about you're introducing Crabmen as one of your player character races, I think that's a great choice. I'm wondering if you're familiar at all with Yuen Suen and the Crabmen in that setting, treated somewhat like slaves, as I recall. Anyway, might be an interesting thing for you to check out. Up to season 2, episode 3 or so. And yeah, the run on Halflings versus Ducks has been fantastic. Halflings versus Ducks, the grudge match. We need to see that in the ring. Myself, I am one of those people who also like kind of the sword and sorcery flavor games, and so I tend to use human-only campaigns. But I love all of the arguments I've heard on your podcast. I mean, the call-ins have just been fantastic. They've given me so much inspiration for how I might do things differently. And as I've been running a retro clone of Holmes Basic recently, I have allowed for the other demi-humans, though I try to give them my own spin for my campaign. In my campaign, I think of their place in the world and how they would kind of be pushed around by the bigger races. They're not going to be in the prime farmland. They're going to be kind of pushed out to deserts and swamps and dense rainforests, place like that. So they're going to be kind of survivalist, scrappy underdogs, maybe an oddity in a lot of the human lands. Finally, I'll refer you to Ultraviolet Grasslands, where the creator has made a mythical race of Lings, L-I-N-G-S, and from them we have kind of the crossbred halflings, as well as quarterlings.
Quarterlings, I like that. That's kind of sweet. Yeah, there's a few things there. I suppose I hadn't really thought about that, but when you go back to the source material, you go back to Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, you do kind of think, why wasn't the Shire sacked earlier? I mean, before the engagement of hobbits in more adventurous global world events, you can't imagine they would have done a great job. Now, I'm going to get all the call-ins, people going, yeah, actually, there are all these great Hobbit war heroes, there's all this history in the other books. Yeah, fine, I'm going to shut up now. So having said, why wasn't the Shire just sacked earlier? Why hadn't the bigger people come and killed them and taken their stuff? I'm sure I've never been inspired. That's another thing I've found going through the shelves. I've got all this other Tolkien stuff that I've gathered up over the years. I've got no inclination to go and look at. So I'm sure that question is answered somewhere out there in the lore. Yeah, on ducks, I mean, I've gone from that sort of one throw out dismissive line about ducks. Ducks are just silly, to being absolutely obsessed by them. So my Black Hat game just ended up being all about ducks. Ducks had ruled the land in some ancient time, and there were just constant references to ducks. I did some nice things. So there was a raven goddess. There was a raven goddess with a big pointed beak. And at one point, Shandy Andy's character picked up a matching piece of stone, a little shard of stone, because Shandy Andy likes his rune quest, and you know, you'll have heard him in the duck episodes. And at one point he realised, he's like, oh, I'll just try it out, because I mentioned again that the stone matched the statue, and he found this elsewhere in the temple, and he replaced this bit of stone onto the raven goddess's beak, and it turned out she had a flatter duck-like beak rather than being a raven goddess. So he discovered a sort of ancient heresy, you know, that actually the raven goddess had been a duck originally, and lots of things like that. And I've thrown some other things out more recently about a science fiction game that's all ducks. And there was a talk, we didn't get it together, but there was talk of doing a 13th Age in Glorantha game that was all ducks. I've definitely got some duck issues to work through there in my games.
Hey Dave, Roy here. I was rather delighted by the unexpected turn that your podcast took into Roland Barthes and Martin Heidegger. Yeah, great stuff. You ask if anybody wants more of that. Yeah, I'm all in. Let's go for it. It's been decades since I've had to read any of that stuff, but I don't get enough of that stuff in my daily life. Full steam ahead.
Well, thanks for the appreciation. I don't know how much I can generalize that response. I don't know if people really more generally want to listen to. I always have a little bit of a crisis when I put those ones out. I haven't done much of that recently. There was a while when I said, "Oh, I'm gonna focus a little bit more on game theory." There's a nice crossover there between my philosophy work that I do and the gaming. Did a couple of episodes around the player expertise stuff, but I've not been motivated to do that recently. It's funny, the title of this call-in was Martin and Roland, and I thought actually that it was going to be about the Dark Tower. There we go. It wasn't.
Hey Dave, Roy here. Really enjoyed your interview with Griffith Monmorgan III. Just a great interview. I mean, he's collected such a wealth of information from these guys that were with the early part of the games. Can't wait for the other films to come out. I've already bought the first one. One of the things I was curious about, so I agree with Ray Otis that Dave Wesley doesn't get enough credit for one of the creators of role-playing games. But one of the questions I had, your episode made me think about a dungeon where you're competing with another team. And in the past, all war games were really about competition between players. And the referee was really there just to enforce the rules. So what I'm wondering is, when did the referee cease to become simply an arbiter between competing sides? When did the competing sides join and become a party, with the only real opponents being presented by the referee? I mean, barring player-on-player competition, which I think still happened a lot, probably more in the early days than now, but even now. I'd be curious to know who was the originator of that innovation.
Yeah, thanks for this, Roy. I really enjoyed talking to Griff. We must do it again, actually. The correspondence has carried on. Griff played in a few of my games. You can catch him on the actual play. He's in those couple of actual plays I put out. That was a lot of fun. He is a lot of fun to engage with. And he's got this huge, the archive that they've got access to. I mean, there's, all being well, there are many, many more films, book tie-ins, all kinds of things, which will continue to mine that vein, which I'm very excited about. One really nice thing was he obviously shared it with the remaining members of the Blackmore Bunch, and I got an email from Dave Wesley saying, I really enjoyed your interview, and if you're ever at GaryCon, come and play my game. come and play my, I think it's my Strategos N game, which I thought was brilliant. So I'm hoping that I'll get to travel and take him up on that offer. That'd be really nice. But yeah, I did enjoy those. I'll see if I can get Griff back on.
Hey, Dave Royer, just calling in to let you know that I listened to the C percentile episode where your wife Claire took over. Absolutely delightful. That was a great, great episode. And the discussion on saving throws, I kind of let it go the first round because I thought a lot of people have better input than me. But since it's come back around, I will just add that for my retro clone, what I've done is reduce it to two saving throws, one for lethal and one for non-lethal. And some of the classes have better odds against the lethal, like the fighter. And some of the classes have better odds against the non-lethal, like the magic user. Hey Dave, I'm enjoying your Dark Sun summaries. Yeah, Dark Sun was a setting that I really loved when it first came out. Although, after the initial box set, maybe with the exception of Wind Riders of the Jagged Cliffs, I felt they kind of took a wrong turn after that. I didn't care for much of the material that came post the initial box set. I've been meaning to make a minimalist slash narrativist rule set for Dark Sun myself, so I'm really looking forward to diving into your rules. Sounds like you've saved me the trouble.
Yeah, Dark Sun, I do really enjoy it, and I quite resent settings where there's a lot of lore. You know, I've said on the podcast I really like Zweihänder because it's Warhammer fantasy, but I don't have to know all about the Warhammer world. RuneQuest I'll never run, just because I just know all my players will be knowing more about the lore than I do. And I always get around that and say, you know, this is my world, it's my version, the lore will be different. But there's just something about those worlds with a whole bunch of lore. But for some reason, I've just enjoyed pouring through all of the Dark Sun material, finding ways of, found some really fun ways of, you know, it has got a big meta plot, so that my overriding aim is to just subvert that meta plot rather than the players watching the meta plot unfold, because a lot of it unfolded in the novels, which are surprisingly, you know, just that first set of novels, surprisingly good, actually. They're surprisingly good quality. I really enjoyed reading them. But yes, I don't know what it is. I normally don't like doing that. I normally just want to get the mechanics, start making my own world. But I've really enjoyed going through it, getting to know it. There are some gems in there. So you mentioned Wind Riders. Yeah, that's a Monty Cook penned supplement. And also the other one I really like, City by the Silt Sea, which is a nice mega dungeon with some really interesting lore to discover, is a Shane Lacey Hensley one. So there's some good writing in there. So I carry on thinking about Dark Sun. I mean, the homebrew is there, it's out there. I was gonna tidy it up, but I'm not sure I want to now, having played it for a bit and played around with the race tropes and the centrality of the slavery, even when you have a big sort of emancipation storyline running through there. I'm just not sure I know how to put a contemporary spin on that setting. And some of the playing the game, some aspects of sort of racial prejudice that's in there and the centrality of slavery I'm not sure I know how to redeem that stuff. So, but it's been, I mean, I think it remains one of the big, creative endeavours in world building. I mean, it's not up there with RuneQuest, but it's a lot of fun going back through that material, trying to think of what's a distinctively Dark Sun monster. What are the key elements of a good Dark Sun scenario? Yeah, it has been fun. And I'm probably going to draw that campaign to a close in the next couple of sessions. They're down in Undertier at the moment. to make some space for concentrating on old school essentials. But it's been a blast. Spoiler coming, but I really enjoyed this, particularly in light of all the Dark Halfling conversation that we've recapped a bit today. But in Dark Sun, it was the Halflings what did it. The Halflings have been pushed out into the forests where they live in primitive tribal cultures. But the first big race of powerful magic users that started off the whole defiling thing in the Blue Age, where, you know, all was water and luxury, was the Halflings. It was them. They did it. And then later on, it was a Halfling sorcerer who decided that they wanted to destroy all the other races and bring the Halflings back to their central place, and that started off the whole evil dragon thing that plagues the contemporary situation in Dark Sun. So that was, I mean, it, I didn't get a chance to do that big reveal in my campaign, but yeah, it was all the Halflings' fault.
On your session on editing, I heard you volunteering to be a free editor. Are you mad? You must be swamped now by a deluge of submissions.
Ah, the editing thing. Yeah, all right. But it hasn't really been put to the test. I'll stand by that. I'll edit for a credit. I will stand by that. So I did get a little... I'm not sure if they were direct calls. I saw some calls for people to get involved in proofreading of various products. But then having answered those calls and got the continuing correspondence, I realised that there's a whole bunch of people been asked to do it. And as we go, it's like, here's a new edition because I've got a load of corrections from this person and that person and that person. If there's one thing I resent more than getting a poorly proofread product, it's doing proofreading work which somebody else is also doing. So I'm picking up things which have already been picked up and acted on, so I don't want to do that. But the more specific offer, I'll edit for a credit, I'll do it carefully, I'll go through it with a fine-tooth comb. Let's see if it becomes too onerous. As I say, there hasn't been any specific take-up of that, but one thing I don't want to do is be doing editing work at the same time as somebody else is doing editing work on exactly the same document. I can understand why you would do that if you were chucking it out just for free, you know, a free set of eyes. Then the more sets of eyes you got, the more you're getting picked up. But for me, with someone, well, everybody's time is precious, isn't it? But my time is too precious to be picking up the same mistakes in the same version of a document as somebody else is. So let's see how that goes.
One book to rule them all. Isn't that a bit indulgent? How about a single A4 sheet? Double-sided. My vote goes to Raotis's Sorcerers and Sellswords.
Yeah, good call. I've got Ray's game. Really nice hack of lasers and feelings with typical Ray elements. Few random tables to get the world going, get the sessions going. I really enjoyed that. I did my own little hack of lasers and feelings, which is itself, I stand by it, is a hack of Ron Edwards' Troll Babe. Of course, it's just the one core idea ripped out of that, but it does at least acknowledge the influence. But yeah, I did mine. I called it Excalibur for playing, knights in heavy armour in a pseudo British historical world. I published mine. I didn't need two A4 sides. I published it alternatively as a JPEG image on a tweet and as a Facebook post. You can find it out there. happy to share it with people if they want it. But yeah, you can fit a complete game in a Facebook post. No problem.
On real world player skill, I don't have much new to add given all the input you've already had on this, but I'll just maybe put it a different way. I think real world player skill should count for something, that if a player describes something in more detail based on their real world skill, they should get a bonus to accomplish that task. But at the same time, I think pretend world skills should count for the same bonus. So if they make up a plausible explanation of why this should help them, yeah, I'd give them a bonus on that as well.
Ooh, thanks, Roy. Good one to end on. You know, what do we reward with bonuses? There's some interesting stuff here. So I've been chatting to the worms about it, been reading Ron Edwards' Sorcerer, the big indie game. That was a game where you had a handful of D10s, but if you really wanted to get stuff done, you wanted to make that handful bigger. And you could do that by sort of engaging, exciting, interesting descriptions. The rule that Edwards gave was, you know, if around the table, you kind of, there's a sense that it's made the game cooler, that bit of description, then you gave the extra dice over. And I really like that. That's an interesting thing. That's a mechanic reward for interesting narration, interesting storytelling. I'm not sure that's what you're talking about, are you? You're talking about giving mechanical rewards for cunning solutions. Yeah, and you shouldn't require players to give the cunning solutions if it's built into their character concept that they would know them. But when a player independently comes up with the cunning solution, you give them the reward as if it was built into their character. And I quite like that, but it does introduce an interesting distinction. You know, what does your game mechanically reward? Does it mechanically reward clever problem solving, even if for some characters it's built into their class that they would know how to solve the problem, or does it reward? So those early games didn't, to my knowledge, have a mechanism for mechanically rewarding cool narration, funky stuff, awesome ways of putting things. And that was a big difference with a more narrative-based game, as Ron Edwards described it in The Forge. I must admit, and it's probably because of all my years of indie gaming, that you know, if there is one of those awesome moments, well, I don't know, I'm mixed. If there is one of those awesome moments around the table, everybody goes, oh yeah, that's good, I might be inclined to give a bonus. But on the other hand, I think everybody saying, oh yeah, that's good, is its own reward. Do you know what I mean? Why do you play the game? Is to have those cool experiences, you know, where you do just go, oh yeah, that was awesome. Even a death can be that way. You die and everybody says, oh yeah, that was pretty awesome. That's what you're playing for. So maybe that's its own reward. So I'm kind of mixed on that. And then having said that, if we are rewarding, yeah, do we want to reward the magic user character for coming up with a really cool thiefy way of solving a problem, or do we want to say, look, that's the thief's domain, they get those bonuses? I mean, some people say old school play, very little is actually covered by the mechanics, and most of it is about that problem solving interaction with the dungeon, which is independent of class. But when you look at the mechanics, that's not strictly true. I know the primers say it, but it's not strictly true, is it? The thief gets a whole bunch of cool things that only the thief can do. That's why a lot of people say true old school play, you should ditch the thief. I don't know. Maybe I've just picked at that. I have got a whole other episode, which has been a little bit of hassle to put together, which goes back to the player expertise, player skill stuff. So maybe we'll pick at that scab a little bit more, carry on that discussion. Roy, we're up to date. I'm so pleased to have these messages. Do keep them coming. Sorry I've held on to them for a bit. Thanks everyone for listening. Keep well. I'll catch you soon.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to contact Dave, please leave a message on Anchor, email dpercentile@gmail.com, or find him on Twitter at D_percentile.